Good evening. I'm Robert Gilfillan, and this is Fairbanks Art Review. Tonight we'll hear what it means to be a northerner.
I think there's more security, in a sense, among far northerners because they've licked it. They've battled the elements and so on, and this is especially true of the past.
The anguish of modern dancers.
Most dancers go through relationships or have no time for relationships. And you don't think ahead, and the profession doesn't make you think ahead. Like I said, there's just no pension plan.
The secrets of guitarist exposed.
They actually make false fingernails for guitarists.
Oh, really?
So that if you break them right before a concert or something, you can just put on a fake nail.
All that and more tonight on Fairbanks Art Review. Canadian historian and writer Pierre Burton delivered the main address and received an honorary Doctor of Fine Arts degree at this year's commencement ceremonies at the university campus. The author of 30 books, he is also seen on the Canadian Broadcast Corporation's weekly show, Front Page Challenge. Not only has Mr. Burton written extensively on the Yukon Territory, but the region was also his birthplace. I asked him what effect this had on his life.
Well, it was... Dawson, in a sense, was a typical small town. When I read Tom Sawyer and Penrod and Sam, I related very strongly to the small towns of the 19th century. It was a 19th century small town in that there was no, we didn't have television, movies were rare, there was silence, we had no radio, and we had nothing really amounting to a daily newspaper that we'd call a daily newspaper. We were isolated totally 8 months of the year. We couldn't get in or out except by a very difficult process of 5 days in an open sleigh in 40 below weather, so very few people did that. So Dawson was a small town which everybody knew everybody else and made their own fun. The difference between Dawson as a small town and, say, a rural small town was Dawson was in no sense rural. It was a cosmopolitan. The people who lived there had gone in over the gold rush. There were a great many public school boys from England, for instance, and there were people from all over the world, quite a mix. And so the library was always full. When I went down to read stories in the library, there'd be all sorts of people reading books in the library. Books, I think, were quite big in Dawson when I was a kid. So I learned to read, and I read avariciously, and still do all of my life. Although there was no culture of the kind that we know now, my mother was a music teacher, and she played the piano. She played Beethoven and Chopin. I knew something about them. I didn't know much about art. I didn't know much about symphony music. I didn't know much about opera or the theater. That all came very late in my life compared with my children, who were, you know, surrounded by that kind of thing in a big city like Toronto. But the environment, I think, was a good one for a boy growing up. I think it would be stultifying if I had stayed. But for a kid growing up in the north, the winters weren't a problem. We were cold sometimes, froze our feet, but generally dressed for it. We were outdoors a lot. We hiked a lot. We were out in the river a lot. And I look back on my childhood, and Dawson is very stimulating and very happy.
Now, it's interesting you should say that. We just recently talked to the poet Gary Snyder, who was in Washington, raised in Washington. And he said probably the strongest influence on his writing and his career was mountaineering in the Northwest up there. Do you think that the wilderness, not the wilderness per se, but nature, had a strong influence on your future career as a writer and thinker?
I'm not sure. It may have had I think it had some influence in my future career as a human being, which in a sense means it had an influence on me as a writer. I would think my parents probably had more of an influence later on in my peer group when I was in the late teens. But my parents were remarkably interesting people. My mother was the daughter of a very famous journalist in Ontario, Phillips Thompson. She was herself a writer, albeit a semi-amateur writer, but she wrote for the local paper and she wrote for some of the outside papers. And she was cultured. She'd come into Dawson as a kindergarten teacher. My father was a jack of all trades. He had been a graduate civil engineer. He had learned dentistry somewhere and practiced it. in the winter when there's no other dentist in town. He had been apprenticed to a cabinet maker, and there's nothing he couldn't build from a lampshade to a boat, and indeed did that. He could weave. He'd built his own loom. He was an astronomer who ground his own reflecting telescope. He did algebra problems as a hobby in his spare time when he wasn't reading Anglo-Saxon or Beowulf in the original or Greek or Latin. He'd been a schoolteacher, a French professor. That's how he met my mother. He was holding French class. She came. He had been a school principal. He had been a mounted police associate. He'd been a cook. He'd been a miner. He was in the gold rush, and so he was a remarkably instructive man. You couldn't spend more than 5 minutes with him without learning something, and I learned a great deal from him. I had a very my parents had a very close relationship. You see, I was living in a town where my father came home for lunch. Now, that doesn't happen in the outside world. Fathers never come home for lunch. They're too far away, and they don't want them home anyway. But my father was home for lunch every day. He was a civil servant the last 25 years of his life, so at 4:30 he was through. He had built a boat, and in the summer we'd get in the boat and go out in the river. So it was a rather free life, although my parents weren't disciplinarian. They had rules, and I learned to live with the rules. I learned that I couldn't leave the house without asking permission. I couldn't go to the movies without asking permission. This is before grade 8. Later on it changed, of course, but I couldn't go down the street to play with my friends without asking permission. I had to be in bed at a certain time. I had to do my homework at a certain time. None of these rules bothered me particularly, but it said was that my parents cared about me, which they cared very, very deeply about, both myself and my sister, and therefore we had a very strong, well-knit home life, and I think that was as important as the environment, since it gave me a sense of security, which I think is useful in a writer.
Well, let me jump into the question of whether you think British culture. I had the opportunity last year to talk with Robertson Davies,
mm-hmm.
and we just did a special on Glenn Gould.
Yes.
And I noticed with each of these gentlemen in particular a strong feeling of identification, if not overtly, but at least in style and somewhat covertly, in just their approach towards life, a strong sensibility of Great Britain, or at least the culture of Great Britain. Do you think that's been a strong influence in your career?
Well, certainly I'm of that age. I think it's less so now of young Canadians, say of my kids going to school. For instance, we got a lot of Canadian history when I went to school, and we also got a lot of British history. We got no American history whatsoever. I knew nothing about the United States. I knew all the kings of England and all the heroes of England, from Harold the Wake and Alfred the Great up to Henry VIII and Dickens and all these people. The books I read as a boy were English books. They were annuals like Chums and the Boy's Own Annual and smaller books about a schooling system which I wasn't familiar at all, which is the British public school system, and with words which I had to learn what they meant, like tuck, which meant food. And prep and stuff like that. And my father was an Anglophile, certainly. People thought he was English, although he didn't have an English accent. But he'd been in the Army, in the Canadian Army during World War I. He was a very strong conservative imperialist. My mother wasn't. Her father was a Marxist. He was a Marxist journalist, probably the first Marxian socialist in Canada. And he was against the government and was always losing his job because of that, and was always running radical papers and was in the labor movement. So it was an interesting mixture for me to have that kind of. And this didn't seem to bother either of them. My mother secretly, I know my father voted conservative, and I, being my father's son, was a conservative until I was 19 when I became a radical. But my mother secretly voted. She could only vote liberal. I was as radical as you could get in those days, but I think she did and didn't tell him. But I remember she took me to the first CCF meeting in Victoria when we came out of the Yukon when I was about 13. This was the Social Democratic Party, which is now the NDP in Canada, still a Social Democratic Party. And so I grew up with both influences, the British. British and of course the Social Democratic was British too. You see, it certainly wasn't American. My grandfather was a British Quaker who had come over from England and a journalist.
Well, let me then follow up on that and ask you what drove you to write about history? What appealed to you in terms of that avenue of literary arts?
Yeah, it's a good question, because all my books, as you know, the early books weren't about history at all. I wrote The Comfortable Pew, which was a critique of the church, and The Smug Minority, which is a political book. I wrote three books of humor and a book of expose and a book of geography about the North and a book about the British royal family, among other things. Now, what got me into history was the Klondike, quite simply. I decided, I was looking around for a book to write. I'd written a couple of books, and I was looking around for a good subject. And I had been doing talks on the radio about the gold rush, picking up material here and there. And I thought, my God, of course I should be writing a book about the Klondike gold rush. I'll see what's available. And I did. It took me a long time. And I enjoyed it so much that finally I found that was the most fun to write, a narrative story of an exciting and epic. I write epic stories, building of a transcontinental railroad, the War of 1812, the filling up of the prairies, the Dion Quintuplet phenomenon, that kind of thing, or shorter pieces. But that got me into it, and I found that I could do it, and I found it was successful, and I just my bent was that way.
Do you think that type of history, for example, there are many people who would know as much about history, English history, if it weren't for Thomas B. Costayne, or about the South Sea voyages of the Bounty, if it hadn't been for Nordoff and Hall? Do you think that that type of history, rather than the straight-laced academic type of history, serves the public better?
Not better. I think there's certainly room for both kinds. Nordoff and Hall, instead, wrote a novel. I think we better make that clear. They didn't write history. There's really two strains of history. There's what is sometimes called popular history, which is funny because it suggests the other kind of history is unpopular. Well, which is really narrative history. That's the kind of history that Bernard DeVoto wrote, that Barbara Tuchman writes. It's, in a sense, the kind of history that J.D. P. Taylor in England writes and people like that. Then there's academic history. Academic history is written for other historians, really. It's written for a small group. And it's history that attempts to throw new light on the past and to make analytical assumptions. Narrative history does that too, but it's not as obvious. A narrative history, if it's any good, should make analytical assumptions, but they shouldn't be laid out as analytical assumptions. They should be inherent in the subject matter. And they should tell you something about the human spirit. For instance, now, Klondike is purports to be a book about the Klondike Gold Rush, and is indeed a fairly definitive book about the Klondike Gold Rush, and is seen as that now. But it's a book about something else entirely, really. It's a book about man's search for himself. And I think if you don't have that underlying theme in your narrative history doesn't have the depth or the power that it should have. So when you're writing narrative history, I think a writer should say to himself, what am I really writing about? And what I was really writing about in Klondike was how people behave under stress, as in they do in a war, how the men are separated from the boys, but mainly about how the human being, whether he goes over the Chilkoot Pass, of a real Chilkoot Pass or a Chilkoot Pass of his own making, is really searching for himself, trying to find himself. And the opening quotation in Klondike, which is on the flyleaf, suggests that, and that's the only time I've ever said it out loud, but it's there. The War of 1812 is an anti-war book, really. It's a book about the stupidness of war, and it's as much a book about the War of Vietnam as it is a book about the War of 1812. My two books on the building of the railway are nationalistic books. They're books about a great Canadian epic, and what they're saying is we can do it just as well as any other country in the world. If we could build a railway across Canada 4,000 miles and to a part of the country that nobody ever been before, we can do anything. So I think you've got to have those underlying things in mind. Now, that's not the same as analytical history. The book I've just finished, The Promised Land, which is about the settlement of the West, is in a sense more analytical than some of the books I've written, that I've tried to examine why the Westerners in Canada act the way they do today. And it's because the whole Three Prairie Provinces were really, their personalities were formed in a very brief period, 14 years, not very long. And I think you should know that. Now, the other thing is the difference between narrative history and scholarly history is some narrative history is very bad. It's written by journalists who haven't learned their craft as historians. And I think the journalists have to learn the disciplines of history. But some scholarly history is almost unreadable because the professors don't know how to write, and I think they should take courses in writing if they're going to get... otherwise, they shouldn't jeer, as they sometimes do, some of them, at popular historians.
Yesterday, I understand you evoked yourself or refer to yourself as a fellow northerner.
Yes.
And Glenn Gould had that famous program, The Idea of the North. What do you think the idea of the North is, or How do you perceive yourself as a northerner, and what does it mean to be a northerner?
Well, it's my heritage. I think, all Canadians are northerners, except for Alaskans, compared to the Americans. We are north of the United States, therefore we are northerners, and the only people who are equally north and farther north than we are the Alaskans. That's why there's such a real bond between Alaskans and Canadians. Northerners, I think, act differently because they are northerners. I think they act with more. I think there's more security, in a sense, among far northerners because they've licked it. They've battled the elements and so on. And this is especially true of the past. I have a section in Drifting Home about this in which northerners are much more taciturn than southerners. Now, let's take example: Scandinavians, the Scots, and the Canadians. To me, they're all of a piece as compared with, say, the Spanish, the Portuguese, and the Mediterranean peoples. Or let's take the New Englanders and the Georgians. You see the difference. The southern peoples are very effusive. They're wide open. They're ebullient. They're lively. They live under the hot sun with lots of rich colors. And they live out of doors because it's warm. They open the doors and their windows and they shout in the streets and they jostle each other. And they're much more emotional. We think of Americans, we Canadians, as a very emotional people because you put your hand in your heart when you do the oath of allegiance. We never do that. We don't have an oath of allegiance. We wouldn't put our hand in our hearts. That's an emotional thing. And we Canadians are much more phlegmatic about things like patriotism. Doesn't mean we're not anymore. We don't have a love of country. We do, but we don't go on shouting about it. We don't have a single patriotic song in Canada. The only national anthem is "O Canada." You have dozens: "America, America, America the Beautiful." All those army songs about the Yanks raising the flag in the Iwo Jima Isle, and the caissons go rolling along, and the shores of Tripoli, and all this. To us, that's not something you boast about. We don't feel we have to. And it's I'm not trying to put down Americans here because sometimes I wish we did a little more about it myself, being a journalist and kind of ebullient. But northern countries are closed-in countries because people live indoors. The doors are closed. And I think the doors are closed in many ways.
You know, I studied as a kid the literature and mythology of Norway and mm-hmm. the Scandinavian countries. And my family comes from Alaska, and what I notice is that although they haven't had the time to develop it, there is the seasons play their part in the formation of this mythology, this, as you say, perhaps phlegmatic, but also when those passions are aroused violently. And in the sagas, Njal's saga, when a venge occurs, it's vengeance with a capital R.
But that's that is Norwegian. It's not Canadian. We're not a very violent country. Our history is relatively bloodless. We don't have lynchings. We don't have we don't really have revolutions. We didn't have a Wild West. Nobody carries a gun. I'm always astounded by the number of people that I know in the States who always seem to have a gun in their pocket or in the glove compartment or in the door. Well, in Canada, you're not allowed to. Never were. Our West was developed differently. Our Indians weren't as crazy as American Indians. And perhaps they had less reason to be. I don't know. But the Plains Indians were not a warlike. They fought the Crees and the Blackfoot fought a lot. But they didn't really indulge in the kind of thing that you see in American movies about Cochise and Geronimo and Sitting Bull. Now, this may be mythological, I don't know, but some myths, of course, they tell you a lot about the way people think. I think we're a less violent country than some other countries. Not totally nonviolent, but somewhat nonviolent.
What type of continuity do you think exists between the Canadian Northwest and Alaska?
Well, there's a lot. First, we share a very similar history. And as I said yesterday, we share many of the same historical figures. Not all of them. I mean, there's Canadian historical figures and American, but a lot of the liveliest historical figures, the ones I wrote about, for instance, we share equally with Alaska. We also share the climate. It's an identical climate in Fairbanks and Dawson, very similar in Whitehorse. And we share the geography and the geology. We share the environment. The Yukon River runs through both territories. It runs right through the Yukon and right through Alaska. That is a great binding tentacle that ties us, you know. It's like an umbilical cord. When I go to Fairbanks, it looks very much like Whitehorse. You know, if I closed my eyes and stood in the middle of the street, I wouldn't quite be sure where I was except for the American flag, and you also fly the Canadian flag here. But the building's the same, whether they're old log cabins or new flat tops. So obviously there is a social connection here. It's not the same, but it is similar. And it would be nice to see it enhanced because that isn't happening so much elsewhere.
As a writer and journalist, who should we be writing to define ourselves? What writers would you say, fiction, nonfiction, should we look to help define ourselves?
Oh, gosh, I wouldn't be presumptuous enough to tell you. I think... I don't know. I read a lot of American fiction, God knows, and enjoy it. I think some of the best fiction in the world is produced. Oddly enough, a lot of it in the southern United States. I was a great Hemingway fan, as everyone in my generation was, and a great Faulkner fan. But my hero, I guess, of all writers is Mark Twain. I don't think there's a better, the country's produced a better writer than Mark Twain. I think he is just marvelous. And as a writer, to read his The Literary Offenses of Fenimore Cooper is one of the most marvelous pieces of writing. And Fenimore and Cooper's literary, he's written two essays on Fenimore Cooper, which I've never been able to go back and read The Deerslayer again since Mark Twain demolished Fenimore Cooper. But for those people who want to write, I think Harold Ross edited The New Yorker on Fowler's English Usage and Mark Twain's essay on Fenimore Cooper. That was his Bible, and you could do wrong by going with it. No wrong by going with those.
Maybe I should have framed it as, what would you say as a northerner, what books that have you read helped you to see a new facet of yourself as someone from the north and from your culture, either Canadian or
I haven't. I couldn't name one. We don't have much of a body of what I've called literary northern writing that I know of. Jack London I liked very much when I was growing up. I felt he knew something about the north. And I think a couple of his stories are superb, and I think his description of the Dead Horse Gulch was so good that I quoted it rather than make a description of my own. I couldn't top it. It was just a marvelous paragraph, and I used it in Klondike. I don't think he was a great writer, but he evoked a certain thing about the North. His short story, To Build a Fire, for instance, is one of the great classic short stories. And, of course, he took real incidents like the Great Staking Race and made short stories out of them. Less so Rex Beach or James Oliver Curwood or any of the others, but London certainly. I was influenced heavily by Robert Service, whose vision of the North is very romantic. The interesting thing about Service is he made the Gold Rush come alive and he wasn't in it. He was 10 years later. People think he was in the Gold Rush. He wasn't anywhere near it. But Service at his best, and he wrote an awful lot of drivel, which he admitted himself, but Robert Service at his best, nobody else evoked the feeling of the North as Robert Service did. If you read The Spell of the Yukon, which is a very fine poem indeed, and just gets it right, just gets it right. And his Law of the Yukon, less so some of his ballads, I don't think, although I recite The Shooting of Dan McGrew at the drop of a hat at parties, it is really a Western American idea, which Service wrote before he reached the Yukon, or reached Dawson, you see. He wrote it in Whitehorse, and same with The Cremation of Sam McGee. But The Spell of the Yukon has got it. You know, the summer no sweeter was ever, the sunshiny woods all a thrill, the grayling a leap on the river, the bighorn asleep on the hill. It goes on and on. The winter, the brightness that blinds you, the tight landlock, tight as a drum. It's a beautiful, beautiful poem. It's this country. Whether it's Alaska or the Yukon, doesn't matter. It's the same thing.
I could go on for hours, but I see some people are waving at me, and it's time to sign off. Pierre Burton, thank you very much for coming.
You're very welcome.
That was historian, writer, and journalist Pierre Burton, who spoke at this year's commencement ceremonies. Last Saturday, Bay Area dancer Karen Addicks wound up her two-week stay in Fairbanks by giving a performance, which consisted of two solo pieces and a group piece, which the Dance Omnium performed to her choreography. Her expertise was astounding, and it was refreshing to see what modern dance was capable of. I asked Claire West to interview Addicks about the frontiers of modern dance.
Karen, modern dance is your field. Can you give me an idea of what is happening to modern dance in the United States these days?
First of all, the name is changing. We call it postmodern now. And that's even passé. It's becoming a pre-minimalist abstraction. other than all, you know, the name change, the name game of dance, I think what's happening is it's just busting wide open in terms of its definition as a movement form. And it's incorporating just about every dance style and form that exists. And not only that, it's going beyond dance into athletics and taking from areas such as aerobics and weightlifting and ice skating. And it won't be before long before it gets into every sport. The fact of the matter is you have Twyla Tharp, who is our foremost female choreographer, and she is now studying boxing. And with Melissa Fenley, an up-and-coming dancer, doing marathon running and Nautilus workouts, it's just amazing what is happening to it in terms of its vocabulary. It's taking on many new languages of movement.
What brought that on? I mean, why is Tharp studying boxing, and why are all dancers going to the weight rooms and running and taking aerobics? What brought it on? Weren't they strong enough to begin with?
Probably not. Modern dance has always been at the avant-garde. It's always been pursuing new frontiers, and for the longest time it just rebelled against the classical form, and that was its frontier, to take off the tutu and the toe shoes and learn about the floor and giving in to your weight rather than trying to work against it. So that was enough for a while. Then you have Merce Cunningham coming along and saying, okay, well, let's do away with music and theatrical devices such as story and costumes and props and open it to an abstract language. And so that occupied a lot of territory, certainly during the 50s and the 60s. And then you have the big movement of the happening of the anti-technique movement, which was spearheaded by Yvonne Rainier. Because all of this is happening back in New York City. And that was where we have minimalism and pedestrian and movement coming in and gestures. And I feel what's happening now in the 80s is a backlash to the minimalism of the 70s, to the conceptualism, the cerebralism of the movement form then. And people are getting into energy and getting into power and into strength. And also dance is just becoming younger and younger and younger. And you have to do something with that kind of energy. And because it's still coming out of very urban, constricted areas, people have a lot of physical energy that they can't channel into the outdoors. So they put it into dance.
And they're putting it onto the stage as well as just working out?
Yeah, putting it up on the stage and lighting it. So what you're seeing out there are not greased bodies. It's real sweat.
Is this happening in another dance form other than modern? Are the jazz people taking that kind of an angle to their dancing on stage? Are the ballet dancers?
That, I don't know. I don't really follow jazz because that's a real Broadway form. Jazz, obviously, is very slick and very influenced by the current music phenomena, such as, well, look at Michael Jackson. He's your quintessential singer-dancer now. And with MTV being so popular, jazz has to really compete with some very slick choreography. The ballet world, always, because it's an expensive product and you have big houses, has to be on top of everything. But they're lucky because they have a technique in which they prepare a dancer to do just about anything. And I'm sure what I've seen coming out of San Francisco Ballet especially is that it's wide open to these new forms of movement.
Real energetic as opposed to pure technique.
Energetic. Also contemporary themes. As a case in point, I saw San Francisco Ballet right before I came up here, and they did a very classic kind of Concerto Barocco piece. That wasn't the name of the piece, but it was your typical classic piece in your white tutus to Mozart, the Piano Concerto No. 21, which is very, very popular. That's your Elvira Madigan piece. Then they did a theatrical historical piece choreographed by Robert Gladstein called Psalm, to music by Leonard Bernstein, which was very much like Green Table, if you've ever seen that piece. You know, a tribute to war, and well, a tribute, a statement about war from an Israeli point of view, a Jewish point of view. And then they did, astonished all of us, because I haven't been to the ballet in quite a while, to Beethoven's greatest hits. They were all very well-known Beethoven pieces, his Pathetique and two others. Three torturous Tennessee Williams Streetcar Named Desire-type duets in which they actually stripped down to underwear in the classic opera house. I was quite shocked.
What was the audience reaction?
Well, of course, it's a ballet audience. We all know we don't snicker and go, oh, but underneath our breath, it was like, what is going on? But, you know, they're all beautiful. The dancing is absolutely fantastic, and they're beautiful, tastefully done. But mm-hmm. they're getting into areas of sex and violence. Mm-hmm. And I think dance has finally realized it can't stay in an ivory tower. It needs that audience to meet its bills, and dancers don't want to starve anymore. And there is an audience out there. We have to realize that more people attended ballet last year than they went to football games.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, that's goodness. A fact. You read your NEA handbook, and you realize we have something to say. We don't want to alienate a media-conscious public that's getting tons of information from TV and movies and radio and everything else that bombards us daily.
Are they a discriminating audience?
Well, who's to say what's discriminating? I mean,
are there compromises happening in the art to reach them?
Yeah, that's a huge issue, is accessibility versus integrity. And I think we'll constantly battle it. But I do feel that, especially in the case of San Francisco Ballet, because they don't have a really good home choreographer like Balanchine or Anthony Tudor or even Twyla Tharp, that they have to go for what they know their audiences want. And I'm sure the San Francisco audiences want to see that level of sensationalism. They're getting used to it, and the house was sold out.
And that's good. I suppose that's good, because pack them all in there, bring them all to dance. That's got to be good for them. Who in San Francisco area is prime movers? Who are the prime movers in modern dance or postmodern dance?
Okay. Well, actually, the best word is contemporary.
Contemporary.
We don't have to get into itty-bitsy, nitpicky definitions, I think. I just call it contemporary. In fact, I call myself a contemporary dancer. I'd have to hand it to the Oberlin Dance Collective and the Margaret Jenkins Dance Company. Mm-hmm. They started out Margaret Jenkins for about 12 years ago in Oberlin, 1976. And not only have they built two very fine companies whose artistic statement is neither provincial or derivative, but very much their own, but they've built a space that is attracting sold-out audiences and artists from all over the world, and a very strong board of directors to keep these facilities running, the two companies, the school, because they have ongoing classes, and the performing series, and every evening there's something going on. And it's not just in dance. It's music and theater and lectures and seminars. And they have a little loft studio upstairs that they're renovating for performance. So it's two studio spaces and performing spaces. So I always look to them in terms of what is possible in San Francisco, considering the limited amount of corporate resources we have. It's a funny town because it has a lot of old money that's given to the opera, the ballet, and the symphony without question. But we don't have the huge corporate resources that L.A. has or New York. And
How is a company like Oberlin Dance Collective or Margaret Jenkins Company surviving? How are they making it in these hard times?
One thing, like Margaret Jenkins, she cut down on the number of dancers she mm-hmm. has. So that's one thing you do. They certainly have their development act together, their fundraising act, because with the NEA cutbacks and California Arts Council cutbacks, they have to go to the corporate sector and get very sophisticated in how to raise money that way. They really have to go to the public, to the individual donor, and earned income, get out on the road and make it. But unfortunately, their kind of fees have to be high enough to meet the expenses of travel. And when a sponsor gets to that category of funding, they might look to Paul Taylor and Twyla Tharp and Merce Cunningham, to the big names that they know they can get a house for. So they're in a funny bracket of marketing. They're not that well known, yet they have to have a high fee.
When you say the big names, surely people, this may seem unfair, but maybe surely people are thinking of Cunningham and Taylor as being dated commodities now. Why not go and see what's new? I mean, Jenkins is very innovative, and you may have heard of Cunningham and Taylor for years and years and years, but maybe they're not the postmodernists that you're looking for.
Well, I think it's a question of education. An audience really totally new to dance should see Cunningham and Taylor and Graham. I mean, they're our grandfathers. They're the roots. And besides, they have the best dancers in the country and a very polished product. And specifically, Merce will always be a bête noire. I mean, what's coming out of his mind is amazing.
So it still is continuing to be innovative and seeming very
new. It's because it's his own aesthetic, and having danced with the company and been in the process of his choreography and seeing how it has changed, it's still brilliant. But I know how to watch it also. But I think for like people in Fairbanks and haven't seen a lot of dance, number one in terms of education is watch Dance in America on television, because you can learn a lot there. And try to see as much of the classical forms of modern dance, such as your Taylor and Graham, mm-hmm. Cunningham, Twyla Tharp. And then the other companies coming up, the lesser-known companies, you at least have that base and can go on into maybe a more obtuse form of dance. Another area that we have to consider is performance art, which is springing up all over the country. And it's really an offshoot of what I talked about, the anti-technical mm-hmm. pedestrian mm-hmm. movement. Mm-hmm. And people set in the Bay Area, such as Helen Dannenberg and Deborah Slater, are finally getting a lot of attention, national attention. We'll be going back to New York this summer and to Los Angeles. And it's hard to describe performance art, except it's like a slice of life made real by theatrical means. And it takes some education to watch it. It's very much like reading the new novelists of this time, your Garcia Marquez and Joan Didion. There's not a lot of pabulum to it.
Right.
But if you look at it, it's real life.
Yes, if it's very done well.
Yeah, if it's done well, it's still an art form. It has to be from the soul. And it's very much an inner psychological area that they explore. So it can also be quite threatening.
Yes.
To where your head's at.
I know that a lot of people would probably like to ask you what pressures it puts on you, the fact that a dancer has a short career span, and how do they handle it in general? How do you handle it? And what can you do when it's all over?
Oh, gosh, that's a big question. There is really no way, and I think we're finally realizing how inadequate we are in dealing with the older dancer, because they are put out to pasture without anything, without any pension, any program, any redirectional program. I've just been lucky that while I was developing my repertoire, I had to develop a business of selling it. So I feel I have some skills that I can go into arts administration. Most dancers end up going directly into teaching. And we have a lot of teachers. I mean, not in this area, but we're saturated with teachers in the Bay Area. If dancers are lucky enough and they maintain a relationship during their stormy careers, they can look at something like motherhood, which is a marvelous profession. In fact, my teacher now in San Francisco is expecting twins, former soloist with American Ballet Theater. Huge. But it's tough. It's a tough question. Dance does not prepare you. It's of the moment. It's of the now.
How do you live your life knowing that? You know, when you are going through it, are you very much a live-for-the-moment person? You don't dare think ahead?
When, actually, in my 20s, that was it. Dance, that's all. I ever thought about. I was just lucky enough that my husband was, we were able to maintain a relationship. And that really is my grounding now, that I have that stability. But I'm very lucky in that sense. Most dancers go through relationships or have no time for relationships. And you don't think ahead. And the profession doesn't make you think ahead. Like I said, there's just no pension plan.
Is it harder for women than men to deal with the short career span that they have in dance?
Probably. It's just harder for women than men to deal with careers, period. But for men, they could probably re-enter a field easier. And they're just, I mean, they're brought up to think in terms that they always have to take care of themselves. And they probably, if they're wise, during their dance days would start investing their touring income and have something to live off when they leave. Women, nowadays, I hope to raise my daughter, that she has to be able to take care of herself, but I wasn't raised that way. So I never really thought beyond my dancing years into what I would do. It's hard. It's easier for men to get into dance because there's less competition. And they can, not that they make more money when they're in it. It's not discriminatory in that sense, but it's easier for them to get into the field. And then they could be like Ronald Reagan Jr. and become a writer.
Or an actor. They seem to do that a lot.
It's interesting. Another phenomenon is that a lot of dancers in New York are becoming People magazine items and getting agents and going into the media, just like all your
stars.
Athletes. They're becoming stars.
Mm-hmm.
And else, the whole world of theater and TV and movies, a lot of them are going on to Broadway. Rebecca Wright, I don't know if you've heard
mm-hmm.
of her. She's on Broadway now. Gary Christ. They all do the shows.
There's a lot of glamour about them. They always look good.
Yeah, tons of glamour. Or they can get into the whole physical fitness fad,
yes.
Get their books published, their memoirs.
Right.
And they can take that route. But that's still a hustle-bustle route in terms of a real secure job and a skill.
For the people that have made it to the top as well.
Yeah, to the top. If you're not there, then you're going to struggle.
Is it absolutely terrifying to see to feel the first physical limitations creeping in?
In a way, I mean, I feel I'm kind of on that downhill side myself. But what happens is in your 30s is that you meet that point of efficiency where, yes, you are physically limited. You can't jump around like you did in your 20s, but your mind knows so much more about technique. And you really are in your prime. Some of your best performances happen in your mid-30s. And you can go on. Look at Makarova. Look at Fontaine. But you also know what it takes to get out there on stage and give it what you need to give it. So, you know, graceful exit is hard, and I can't overemphasize it. If you have some kind of relationship, it makes it a lot easier because your sense of self and self-worth doesn't have to decline along with it.
That was dancer Karen Addicks discussing modern dance with Claire West. Karen has traveled extensively as a soloist and performed with the Merce Cunningham Dance Company. She will be taking part in the Dance Olympics this June. Claire West is the founder of Claire West Ballet, and her features are a regular part of Fairbanks Arts Review. You're listening to David Burgess. He was in Fairbanks recently to give a concert. Ron Clark talked in our studios with Burgess about his style and approach to the classical guitar's repertoire.
I play everything from Renaissance music to Bach to South American folk music, some Spanish music, and a little bit of flamenco also.
Mm-hmm. Solo?
All solo. Mm-hmm. I have done ensemble things too, I've played with flute players, string quartets, harpsichord players, mm-hmm. and different ensembles.
You ever have an urge to fulfill your Phantom of the Opera desires to play in front of the Royal Philharmonic or anything like that?
I have done some concertos with orchestras. Not the Royal Philharmonic yet, but I'm
yet.
Working towards it.
Next week, okay.
but there are a lot of nice pieces written specifically for guitar and orchestra. The Spanish ones seem to work real well.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a real preponderance of Spanish composers for guitar. Is that just my imagination? Or?
No. The Spanish are very nationalistic sorts of people. They want to keep along the lines of Spain and spread their culture throughout the world. And so composing for guitar is a real natural thing for a Spaniard to do because mm-hmm. Over in Spain, they play guitar like we play baseball when we grow up.
Mm-hmm.
And so you find probably more Spanish music for guitar than any other, than from any other country. And also, I think just the style of music seems to fit the sound of the guitar a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Like Irish music doesn't work for guitar solo all that well, but Spanish just seems to fit real well.
Yeah. How did you learn to play? Did you grow up in Spain? Or?
No, I started out in high school just playing some rock. And let's see, then the summer I graduated, went down to Mexico and took a class from a very good guitarist. And so after a couple of years, I went back down to Mexico and stayed there for a year studying intensively. I was putting in 8 hours a day or so practicing.
Mm-hmm.
And just kept continuing, mostly on my own since then. That was about 10 years ago or something.
Mm-hmm. You ever been to Alaska before?
No, this is the first for me. Yeah.
Now, what's the climate like this? What kind of effect does that have on an instrument?
Well,
it's cold and awfully dry.
Yeah, the dryness is can really ruin a guitar. It's real thin pieces of wood.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it does dry out, it can crack. You find a lot of guitars in a dry climate like this just fall apart. Sometimes they come unglued. The glue dries up. And so
how do you counteract those influences?
I've got some sponges wrapped in plastic with holes cut in the plastic, and I just keep it wet, keep those inside the guitar.
Oh, really?
And it keeps the humidity up.
Hmm. Keep it soaked up.
I hope.
Yeah, we'll find out. Well, sort of the same subject. How do you keep your fingernails from going all to pieces? I know so. Every classical guitarist I've ever seen has this set of claws that looks like it would be real tough to keep them from catching on your car keys and breaking. And I can just see that. Well, David Burgess will not be appearing tonight because he broke a nail.
I never have much trouble with that. I use this real fine sandpaper to keep them smoothed off so there are no sharp edges on them or anything. And other than that, I don't have much trouble. I know some guitarists that they actually make false fingernails for guitarists.
Oh, really?
So that if you break them right before a concert or something, you can just put on a fake nail and do it. But I've never had to do that. Then you can actually glue them back. If they break, you can glue them back together with crazy glue. There's all kinds of strange things you can do.
The secrets of the guitar trade, right?
Yeah, well, I heard about somebody that's they're going for a medical degree, and they're specializing in fingernails.
Really?
This is in New York last week, and I was talking to somebody that was doing this.
Great value to guitarists around the world.
I thought so, but it just seemed like, I didn't know their specialties were quite that specialized.
PhD in fingernailology.
Apparently it exists.
You ever had something like that happen, 2 minutes before you were to go on stage, your guitar suddenly springs all its strings, or your fingernails all fall out?
No, probably the worst thing that happened to me was one time I was playing a concert, and just before intermission, my foot had fallen asleep. And it never fallen asleep on me that bad before. But I figured I could get up and walk off stage okay, but when I put my weight down on it, it just buckled underneath me. I couldn't feel my leg from the knee down. So all I could do was stand there for a couple of minutes waiting for it to wake up enough to walk off stage. One of my more embarrassing moments.
At least you didn't collapse in a heap and crash and burn right there on stage.
Well, I heard the tape of the concert afterwards, and the audience was clapping after I got up, and then all of a sudden you hear this big, then dead silence,
What's he going to do? Is he going to keel over?
It was pretty dramatic, yeah.
Do you have any ambitions toward getting any albums out or anything? Or?
Yeah, I've been working on it. There are just a lot of problems with it. I went to one studio and almost finished an album, but then found out there was distortion on the tapes. Just a few chords crackled, so I had to start over. I've almost got one completed now.
Designs on finding yourself a manager here in the future, then? Or?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, I was in New York last week and won a big competition.
Oh.
It was called the Andres Segovia Fellowship Competition.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's a big one.
That was a good one.
Great.
So it's kind of like, it's the closest to overnight success anybody gets these days, apparently, something like that.
Uh-huh.
And
now the managers are calling you.
Well, they haven't started yet, but I'll be moving to New York in the fall.
Oh, really?
And it looks like there's a lot of connections to be made from it. So.
Great. Yeah, I'd say that's a fairly big competition, the Segovia. Jeez.
It's kind of like getting Segovia's stamp of approval
or
something like that. And so it makes you a lot more credible, you know, rather than just another guitarist approaching a manager.
How do they do those competitions? Do you pick the music you play?
Everyone is different. This one, we got to pick some of it, and then Segovia picked some of it, too. He was pretty ruthless when everybody came out to play for the competition. When each person sat down, he asked for the hardest thing on the program right off the bat when you're sitting there cold, haven't warmed up at all. I guess he wanted to test your nerves or something. Uh-huh.
Sounds like a pretty good way to do it.
Yeah.
Segovia breathing down your neck.
It was real unexpected, you know. Mm-hmm. Not the easiest audience I've ever played for either.
I can imagine. Yeah. Do you have any tricks to keep calm in a situation like that?
I try to just anticipate everything so that it seems like I've been through it all before by the time I get around to doing it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, great. That's a big step. And if you're going to abandon Seattle for New York, you'll be hitting the World Concert Tour program here, and we'll see you back soon, we hope.
Perhaps.
Good.
David Burgess. He just won first place in the recent Andre Segovia competition. My thanks to Ron Clark of Fairbanks Morning for his interview. Alfred Hitchcock films, which haven't been released in over 20 years, are coming to Alaskaland. Summer is the prime season to release new films, but at Alaskaland, they'll be giving George Lucas and Steven Spielberg a run for their money.
We've got 6 films, 2 westerns, 2 comedies, and 2 Alfred Hitchcock thrillers, so it looks interesting.
A wide range, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, what do we start off with then?
Starting next week, we have Ride the High Country, which is a Western from 1962. It's been called the best Western to come out of the 60s. I don't think many Westerns were made in the 60s. But
that includes the Magnificent Seven and all?
Well, that's true. Ride the High Country is Randolph Scott, Joel McRae. They both came out of retirement to make this film, and it's called their swan song. The last thing they did, and many people think the best thing they did, has to do with the fading West, the vanishing West, and their morals or their principles against the way the West was. And kind of typifies maybe the spirit of the 60s, too. That was a time of transition, and this film is about a time of transition in the West. It's directed by Sam Peckinpah. It was the first film he did for the big screen. He did a lot of TV Westerns before this.
No kidding. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So the birth of Peckinpah, is it violent? You know, violence is usually associated with Peckinpah's direction.
Yeah, no, I don't think so.
Hmm. It should be interesting to see him under that kind of restraint in that early years. So a Peckinpah film with a re-emergence of Randolph Scott and Joel McRae.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's followed by Lonely Hearts. Now, last time you were here, we talked about Lonely Hearts, but because the distributor had some problems sending that up, you had to postpone it to this month.
Right. It wasn't out in 16 millimeter at the time.
Oh, so that would pose a problem.
Yes, but it should be now. In fact, it is now, and we'll be having that June 4 through 6, and it's a comedy from Australia. Norman Kay, who plays the male lead, spent most of his life taking care of his mother. She was bedridden, so he's in his 50s when she dies, and he meets the girl at the funeral of his mother, and she's also been living at home. She's just now moved out into her own apartment, although she's middle-aged. Pretty, but very repressed, and this is the story of them getting together and trying to make a go of it.
An Australian, and who's the director of that one?
Paul Cox.
And he was the fellow, was he the one who did, no, it isn't Local Heroes director.
No.
Or producer, okay. There was one that shared a producer with
Right, the next film, Experience Preferred but Not Essential.
And again, that's a film that you brought up for this
right.
month
mm-hmm.
because it wasn't available for some reason last
yes.
month. And now what's Experience Preferred but Not Required?
It's a story of a girl who travels to the Welsh coast to work as a waitress the first summer before she goes away to college to earn some money. And the experience she gains by working in this hotel and working with the strange characters that are in the hotel that work there and that board there. Also kind of a love story, kind of a coming-of-age story
mm-hmm.
and a comedy.
Now, when is that playing? And maybe we should also say when Lonely Hearts will be playing during the month.
Right. Experience Preferred plays June 18 through 20, and preceding that is Lonely Hearts, June 4 through 6.
Okay. What's this?
The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez.
Yeah.
I'm real
what's that?
Excited to see that. I haven't seen it yet. It played once on public television, which is why it's had a hard time being distributed to the theaters. But it's a Hispanic film. It's in English. The main character, Edward Olmos, speaks only Spanish in the film, but the film is English. It's been marketed by the main characters and the producer. They've been taking it around to theaters personally, shaking hands with people, asking them what they think after the film is over. It's a true story about a Hispanic person who he's the object of a huge manhunt because he killed a person. He killed a sheriff who killed his brother, and the whole basis of it is a misunderstanding. The interpreter interpreted something the sheriff said wrong, and it made it sound like a threat. So this is how the crime was committed. And the interesting part of the film is it's shown, the opening shot is a huge chase. You see pounding hoofs of horses, and it's the old-fashioned story of someone on the lam. And then they keep going back to the scene of the crime, showing it through different people's point of view, what happened.
Is this a Western then?
Yes,
horses?
It is. It's a modern Western. 1983 it was made.
And it takes place in Texas or...
In Texas,
in
right.
In Texas. Uh-huh. And it's gotten good reviews?
It's gotten excellent reviews by the people who have seen it, but very few people have seen it. It's hard to market a low-budget film with a no-star cast, but the people in it give remarkable performances. And, in fact, the main character... Edward Olmos has turned down parts in major films like Scarface in order to market this, go around the country with it and show people, because he is Hispanic and he believes it shows, it has good morals in it.
Mm-hmm.
And he says he wants to market this film rather than go big time with other parts he could have had.
So a real gem of a sleeper we can expect. With
yes, I'm excited to see it.
Yeah, it does sound awfully exciting. And that's playing when?
That plays June 25 through 27.
Okay. Now, all these films are ended, the run of these films ends up with two very rare, because they've just been re-released, Alfred Hitchcock films. We'll have a chance to see Vertigo and Rear Window.
Mm-hmm. It's been more than 20 years since they've been released, so there'll be a lot of the audience who have certainly never had a chance to see it.
Oh, this would be really exciting. Talk to us a little bit about Vertigo and Rear Window.
Well, both of them star James Stewart. Vertigo, he plays a San Francisco detective who's hired to tail the blonde wife of his client. And he does tail her. And previously in the film, it's established that he has vertigo or acrophobia, fear of heights. It starts out with him chasing someone across the rooftops, and he ends up dangling by his hands from a rain gutter, you know, and you know he has a problem. So he's,
wouldn't we all if we were dangling by a rain gutter?
He sees someone fall to their death, the person he was chasing, or another detective. And he tails this wife, and... she goes up a stairway, and he sees her fall to her death. Second person he's seen fall to their death. And, of course, his vertigo takes over again. Later on in the film, he meets a shopkeeper, a girl, who looks very much like this woman. And he falls in love with her. And I don't know if I should give away the whole plot.
No, don't.
I won't.
I know the plot of it, and it would be anticlimactic in some respects.
We'll stop there and let people come and see it. It's
with James Stewart, right?
James Stewart, Kim Novak.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that'll be marvelous to see. You know, I understand that both Vertigo and Rear Window are considered the best films that Hitchcock ever turned out. And, of course, he's one of the finest filmmakers. So we're, in essence, seeing the creme de la creme of Hitchcock filmmaking. Why don't we talk a little bit about Rear Window? And that's, again, with James Stewart, isn't it?
Yes. In Rear Window, he plays a freelance photographer who's laid up in his apartment with a broken leg. He's in a wheelchair. And so he spends his time looking out his window and using telescope, dropping in on the neighbors. And his girlfriend is played by Grace Kelly in one of her most just gorgeous roles. And through his voyeurism, he convinces himself that the neighbor has killed his wife and chopped her up in little pieces. The neighbor is Raymond Burr. And he convinces Grace Kelly and the nurse, Thelma Ritter, she has a good little part there, to become his legs and go, you know, investigate this further. And from then on, it gets more and more complex.
That was Laurel Stalky of Alaska Land Cinema talking about some of the features you'll be able to see this summer. For a schedule of the films or for more information, call 456-8906. That's all for this evening. My thanks to Carla Tanella for engineering and to the Public Affairs Office at the University for arranging the interview with Pierre Burton. For KUAC, I'm Robert Gilfillan. Good night.